This is the Canadian Investor, where you take control of your own portfolio and gain the confidence you need to succeed in the markets. Hosted by Braden Dennis and Simon Bélanger.
Welcome back to the Canadian Investor Podcast. I'm here with Dan Kent. We're back for our regular Thursday news and earnings episode. Dan, so this week I'm sick. You're feeling better?
Yeah.
We should make a friendly bet on when we think we'll both be feeling good for recording. Because it feels like it has had to be at least a month since we've both like feeling good for recording.
Yeah, I've never, like, I typically never get sick, but for some reason, this has been the second or third time since I've been on the podcast here. I mean, I promised to try and not hurt people's ears this week, because yeah. It was probably pretty bad last week.
Yeah, after we were done recording, I could see Dan searching for a piece of his lung on the floor. So for me, it's just, that little, my daughter, 18 months, and she's just, like, catching every single thing from daycare. Catching it. So I'm just hoping that after this one, I'll be good for a good chunk of this spring. That's my hope, because I guess we're officially in spring now.
Yep. It doesn't feel like it here. It is not good.
Well, speaking of spring, I don't know if it's a good transition, but I guess it's springtime or looking positive for Nuve, who announced that it was going private. So do you want to tell us a bit more on that deal that was announced yesterday?
Yeah, so if you were listening the last few weeks, we talked about the possible chatter of Nuve going private, but nothing had actually happened yet, but the stock went up like, I think it was 35 or 40% based on the news. So just like some insight into Nuve, they're a payment processing company. They IPO'd, I think it was in 2021. Ryan Reynolds is a major backer, and they were halted early Monday morning. And it seemed like at that point, it was kind of inevitable that a deal had been made. It just depended on, you know, what the premium was. So the deal is for $34 a share, which is a low single digit premium to what the stock is trading at right now. I'm a bit surprised as to why it's trading below the acquisition price, because I don't really see any way that this deal doesn't go through. An article I read pretty much said that the transaction has the support of shareholders Philip Fayer, Nuve's founder, chairman, executive, NovaCap, and I'm not exactly sure. How do you pronounce that? Caisse
de dépôt et placement du Québec, which is the managing arm of the QPP, so the Quebec Pension Plan, amongst other things. So they manage that money, but other things as well. But yeah, it's CDPQ, if you want to say the initials. It's probably easier, CDPQ, if you want to say that.
I knew I was not getting that one right. But yeah, they so they represent roughly 92% of the voting shares. And they've kind of said, you know, they're all right with this deal. So typically you would see a company trade at a bit of a discount to the purchasing price if the market, you know, believes the deal may fall through. I'd say the most notable situation we saw with this would have been when Activision was being purchased by Microsoft. So there was a lot of rumors, you know, speculation that the deal might fail because regulators may shut it down. So it traded, that one was a much larger discount. I think it was trading at like a 20 to 25% discount to the acquisition price. I ended up buying it actually, and it ended up being a pretty good play because it kind of maintained that price level throughout the whole bear market in 2022. And then the deal eventually closed in 23. So while the S&P was kind of taking a beating, this kind of held steady. But this one kind of seems like a done deal for the most part. Unless another company steps in and offers more. But even then, I don't know. I'm kind of confused as to why it would trade at a premium unless it's leveled out today, but I don't think it has. Fair, who is the founder of Nuve, will remain
trading at a discount at this point?
It is.
Okay.
It's trading at a discount to the acquisition price by, I think, around $2 a share.
Yeah, so probably like around 5% discount, roughly.
Let me see here. No, it's actually leveled out. So it has leveled out this morning. It's only trading at about a 20 cent discount to the price. So yeah, it was trading at a discount, but obviously the market is pretty confident that this is going to go through now. So it's kind of leveled out. But I mean, the discussion on just how these companies do end up trading at a discount to acquisition prices is still rings true. I mean, it's typically when the market doesn't feel the deal is going to go through or there's a chance that it could fall out. So the entire leadership team is sticking around, and the buyer is Advent International. It's a US-based firm. They've been making deals in operation for more than 3 decades. It's expected to close in the latter half of 2024 or the first quarter of 2025. And for many people who've purchased Nuvve, it's probably at higher levels than this. So for a lot of people, the mid $40 premium likely isn't going to be enough to get them into the green unless they, average down for quite a bit while it took a bit of a beating over the last few years. By the looks of it, they IPO'd at around $5.8 billion in 2020, and this deal looks to be in the low $6 billion range. So it's like not much more than their IPO price, which is a bit surprising. But I mean, overall, there's been a huge reset in the valuation of payment processors. Because at its peak, this company had a market cap of nearly $25 billion. So you're looking at a $25 billion, market cap, and I think that was probably October, November 2021, to just, selling for just over $6 billion now. But yeah, it seems low to me. I mean, relative to other payment processing companies, I mean, Nuvve was profitable, it was growing earnings, it was cash flow positive, whereas, a lot of the companies like Lightspeed is a bit, they're more cash burn right now. But I mean, this kind of sets a precedent in terms of valuation compared, relative to others. But it's a pretty interesting deal. It was actually, it's a pretty big payment processor here in Canada.
Yeah, and so I have a chart here for our joint TCI listeners. So I have in purple, so you have the returns, total returns of Nuvve, and that's the TSX, right? So it kind of varies depending if you're looking at US or the Canadian listing, just because it's dual listed, and obviously the exchange rate has an impact on that. But purely looking at the TSX listing, it's down pretty much or flat, like it's down 1%. Total returns, because clearly they've been paying, I think, a dividend for a couple of quarters now, which doesn't make all that much sense to me, but it is what it is. And that's compared to if you just take the XIC, which I believe is the TSX 60 fund, which has returned much better. I mean, it's returned less than the S&P 500, but since the IPO, it's returned close to 51%. So unfortunately, for those who bought it around the IPO, like you said, they're down on their investment, and they're definitely trailing the index, but also the S&P 500 or even the NASDAQ, if you want to compare them to a bit more the same kind of tech companies. I'm assuming it's even more pronounced for the NASDAQ. So it's definitely interesting. I think for me, what it tells me is that there might not be that premium anymore for these type of payment processors that people are willing to pay. And I think we talked about that, where I think it just becomes more and more a commodity. You have a couple of big players, I'll say it time and time again, like a Visa, MasterCard. Yeah. I guess you can put Amex in that category, although they're kind of a hybrid between like Visa, Amex, and a bank, I would say, and they're much smaller than the two. So you have those that are kind of the staples, and then you have all the other payment processors. At least that's the way I view it.
Yeah, it's just, and the competition is just so, like, there's so much competition in the space that I think, I'm kind of curious as to why valuations got so high during the pandemic. I guess it was just kind of, low policy rates fueled by just kind of a bit speculative investing, I guess. Because, I mean, the company, so Nuvve sold, it looks to be trailing 12-month EV EBITDA of 22x. And during the pandemic, it was over 40. So you're looking at like almost half the valuation. And it's just like a lot of people expected these to kind of return to higher valuations. But I mean, I think just overall, the competition in the space, like you said, like Visa, MasterCard, the crazy moats that they have. I mean, it's just, I just don't think investors are willing to pay these higher valuations for these companies. And I mean, if you look at the company, it sold for, like I said, practically its IPO price. And it traded on the market for, what would that be, like almost 4 years? It's crazy. And they accept, like, almost unanimously accept a deal for pretty much what it IPO'd at.
A good, nice little round trip they did.
Yeah, exactly. Crazy.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to follow, like you mentioned, I think it was last week, Lightspeed, whether that has an impact on them. I just don't know how much of an appetite there would be to take Lightspeed private just because of what you mentioned. They're not profitable. And typically, from the research I've done for private equity, they tend to focus more on profitable companies. So I think there might be some, I don't know if the demand will be there is what I'm saying. If, you know, Dax is hoping for a similar kind of deal for his business.
Yeah, I just don't see it now. And then even then, like, it just seems, I figured that if Nuve got a really high premium, that it would impact Lightspeed's share price. But I mean, I think this was probably a bit lower than, you know, a lot of holders would have wanted, especially those who bought it, you know, in 2021 and paid like $120, $150 a share. That kind of hurts to, you know, accept $44 now. But yeah, it's an interesting deal. I wonder if this will spur any other deals in that space, but I kind of doubt it.
Yeah, I'm definitely in the same idea. I think it's, we'll have to see I'm missing the name, but which company that's private? They do the payment processing for Shopify. You know which one I'm talking about? They're a super large company. I know they're planning to go public somewhat soon. I think it's the cold. I just can't remember the name.
Yeah, no, I'm not. I can't think of it either. I'm trying to look it up here.
Okay.
I can't.
Well, maybe when you do your next segment, I'll probably look that up because I'm about to start something new. That's okay. I think people will probably be screaming knowing what company I was referring to.
Yeah.
But I know all that to say, I know that their valuation, going public is definitely less than they were expecting. This mysterious company that I can't think about right now, but that's okay. We'll transition to something else, I guess, in the payment space, but a bit different. So SBF, Sam Bankman-Fried, gets 25 years in prison. So in case people are not familiar with the story, I'll just do a quick overview. Because if you're in the finance world, I'm sure you're aware of it. But if you're new to the podcast, you may have heard of this guy or an FTX, but you might not quite know the whole background. So FTX was founded by Sam Bankman-Fried, also known as SBF. During the last crypto bull market, FTX became one of the largest crypto exchanges in the world. Alameda Research, which was a crypto hedge fund primarily owned by SBF, started using FTX customer funds to cover losses resulting from risky crypto and venture bets. It's really hard to know exactly when the problem started occurring, but it's probably safe to say that they started having issues in late 2021 when crypto and unprofitable tech started going down. Obviously, Nuve is an example, although I think they were profitable at the time, but we saw a lot of growth in the stock market, but also crypto started going down from the peaks in late 2021. And then on November 2nd, 2022, CoinDesk, which is a publication that focuses on the crypto space, was able to get the balance sheet of Alameda Research, which showed that it was filled with, sorry for the lack of better terms, but shitcoins, including FTT, which was the token issued by FTX. So essentially what it showed is the balance sheet of the Alameda, the hedge fund, was filled with this kind of created cryptocurrency that was issued by FTX. And there was a lot of intermingling between the two. And from that point on, it took only 9 days for FTX to file for bankruptcy, as it was not able to repay all of its customers' deposits. I mean, if you're interested in the story, I do encourage you. There's tons of documentaries on YouTube that are free. Really interested that kind of details details in order the events that happen. And I know I'm struggling with some words today, just kind of hard when you're all stuffed up. And also, with my French accent. So I do apologize for that. Now, last week, SBF was convicted of 7 counts of fraud and conspiracy by a jury last November, so in 2023. It was actually almost to the day compared to that story when it came out about the balance sheet issues a year prior to that. And last week, SBF received his sentence from Judge Kaplan, who was overseeing the case, to 25 years in prison. Now, the sentence was a bit kind of in the middle between what the prosecutors were asking. So they were asking 50 to 60 years, while his defense was asking in the middle single digits. I think they were asking about like 5-6 years. The defense was arguing a softer sentence because they said FTX customers will be paid in full. Now, that's very misleading, and I listened to the All In podcast, which is very popular with, you know, Chamath and David Sachs and the two others there, Friedberg, and I'm missing one. And I think they, you know, I definitely like hearing what they have to say, but I think they were really wrong when they addressed this, because customers are, yes, they're being paid in full, but that's in fiat terms. And fiat is just like, you know, money that we use every day. But for customers who had Bitcoin and Ethereum, for example, it won't be the case. That's because the amount owing is in USD. So meaning that the people will receive the equivalent of what they had in crypto in USD value at the time of bankruptcy. Well, the issue is that Bitcoin at that time was below $20,000 US, and now it's above $65,000 as we're recording this. So a big chunk of the money they were able to recover was simply appreciation in the various cryptocurrencies that FTX, the estate of FTX following the bankruptcy, had access to. Without that price appreciation, even if it remained like flat from that time to right now, they would not have been repaid in full. Obviously, they made some venture bets, including there was one in an AI firm that did quite well. But again, to me, that would not be a valid reason, even if you're trying to argue that customers will be paid back in full, because you're kind of, you are, but you're not really, right? Just based on what the customers would want back, you're not giving them the choice of having it back in whatever, you know, whether it's in USD or Bitcoin, right? So I think that's a bit misleading, definitely, when, you know, you start seeing that. I wanted to provide some context on that part specifically. Now, anything you want to add before I continue and just take a breather from my stuffiness?
No, I mean, that's, I actually didn't know that, you know, it was only being paid back in USD. I figured it would be in the currency, in the cryptocurrency, no. Obviously. But yeah, clearly, I mean, Bitcoin has gone through the roof. If it was still in the tank, like, it's probably a very different situation.
Yeah, and just to make it simpler for people who are trying to wrap their head around it, just take it this way. So when they filed for bankruptcy last, like about a year or 18 months ago, let's say I had money on FTX. So I had one Bitcoin on FTX. They filed for bankruptcy. The one Bitcoin was worth $20,000. And now, you know, 18 months later, they're saying, well, we're paying you back $20,000, so we're making you whole, even though that Bitcoin's worth $65,000 now. So I think, you know, whatever you think about Bitcoin and not, I think that's debatable whether people were made whole or not. So that's why I think you see the headlines and stuff, and it doesn't bring a lot of this stuff into context. There's been other bankruptcies. I think depending on the bankruptcies, they do give people the option or not. I think there was the Genesis bankruptcy that was also BlockFi. So it's not the only one, but I think some of the other ones, they did it a different way to establish the value. And now just to finish on this, the judge did recommend that he put SBF in a medium security prison in San Francisco instead of the one in New York where he was being held at, because of his vast wealth, his autism, and social awkwardness, which would make him especially vulnerable in a high security prison. In his statement, the judge said SBF committed perjury, was evasive, and repeatedly dodged questions during his trial. SBF apparently spoke for 20 minutes, but did not seem to be remorseful of his actions and put some blame on others, which is pretty consistent with what we've heard from the trial, because it was just accounts from reporters that were attending the trial. And the judge definitely did not seem to appreciate the fact that he wasn't willing to take responsibility. His parents said that they will continue to fight for their son. And for those of you who are not aware, his parents are also facing some legal troubles relating to their involvement with FTX. So that's a whole other story that maybe we can visit at some point. And my thoughts here is that I'm happy to see that he got a tough sentence, and hopefully it'll, you know, act as a deterrent for people to commit white collar crime. you know, whether people want to, you know, paying this with just being specific to crypto or not. I mean, there's a litany of white collar crimes in the traditional financial markets. I don't think it's anything new. My big thing is that, you know, they need to set an example for any type of white collar crime, because it just, it's hard to quantify how it affects people, but I did search and there's definitely at least a handful of people that committed suicide because of this. So I know it's not as straightforward as, you know, someone walks into a convenience store and, you know, kills someone with a gun, but the impact that it has on people's lives, it can actually be way broader and more impactful than a, like, lack of a better term, like kind of traditional crime, if you'd like. And just the fact that SBF is just not remorseful, I think it's just, I just don't understand. I mean, the only thing to say, and I don't know what's causing it, whether it's is the way his brain works, I'm not quite sure, but how you cannot be remorseful with the amount of pain that you inflicted on people, I just don't understand.
Yeah, and that's kind of why I thought, like, the sentence was, I figured he would get more. Like, if you probably, if you consider the amount of money that a lot of people lost, the amount of lives he's ruined, I figured like 25 years was pretty soft. I wonder, can he get out any earlier? Probably can. I would imagine so.
I don't know. I had heard that because it's like a federal sentence, you can't, but I'm not sure. I'm not like, I really am not sure. That's what I heard, but I can't say whether it was like, you know, I'm certain of that or not, to be honest.
I wonder, like, just quickly, do you know what his parents are facing legal struggles? I actually haven't kept up on this story much at all, but I'd be interested to see how his parents are involved.
Yeah, so that was, there's a lot of stuff that came out, I think it was last year, regarding his parents' involvement and just the parents giving kind of legal advice to him.
Oh, yeah, I guess because they're lawyers.
Charging like high fees, yeah, getting paid through FTX. Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm just kind of throwing stuff out there because it's been a while since I looked at that. But yeah, there's definitely, and I think one of the other things was the parents' involvement in doing like donations to politicians in the US. And apparently they were not very, they did not discriminate. They were spreading the money evenly across the aisles. So they wanted to make sure that, you know, it was well received regardless of the allegiance over there. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he deserves what he got, I guess. I would figure he'd deserve more, but because, I mean, the only way you stop this kind of stuff is to come down really hard on people for doing it. And
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, we'll see. Look, I mean, there's been, it's not the only one that, you know, that has done financial crime. I mean,
like, it won't be the last.
To me, the fact that, yeah, exactly. And the fact that there was, I don't know if there was any conviction. Maybe there was one or two from the great financial crisis, but I know there was no
very like,
major convictions, yeah. Very minimal. And I think it's time for, you know, people to be a bit more accountable when there's like egregious cases of fraud like that. Obviously, I know it's not always easy to, you know, to be able to prove that, but I think when you have strong sentences, it acts as a deterrent for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
And before you move on to BRP, so the company I was talking about earlier for the payments is Stripe.
Oh, well, yeah, I figured.
Yeah.
Yeah, Stripe payments. But they're Shopify's main payment processor, so that makes sense.
Yeah, I believe so. They haven't officially announced an IPO date. That's the latest I can tell. But I'm assuming that they're probably keeping an eye on something like Nuve. I know they're much larger than Nuve, but...
Oh, way larger, yeah.
From what I've been reading, last year I did some reading on that, and their valuation was significantly down as well. So that's another example. It'll be interesting what the IPO for, whether kind of what we're seeing with Nuve may translate to a larger company like Stripe if they decide to IPO or not.
Yeah, I was just looking up articles now. They figured like a $65 billion valuation. That's just off a quick search. So you're talking like 10x what Nuve just sold for. I don't know how.
But again, they're in the same space. I know they kind of serve different clients, but I'm sure that it will be part of a potential comp if they're trying to base some prices for an IPO in the future. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, they're integrated across so many things. Like you can pretty much put a Stripe payment gateway on anything you can imagine, really. And Yeah. I don't know how.
Yeah, it's definitely.
I don't know how neither of us didn't think of that.
No, I don't know. Like, I was just like, you know, when you have that, like, it's at the tip of your tongue, but you just can't think about it. Enough about that. Let's talk about some Ski-Doos and Sea-Doos.
Yeah. So BRP, which is Bombardier Recreational, like no main relation to the Bombardier stock. They're separate. They've been separate for 20 some years, I think. So they reported revenue and earnings that missed expectations on both the top and bottom lines. So this company is pretty well known for topping expectations. So it was a bit of a surprise. And then in addition to this, it downgraded its guidance. I'll get to the guidance in a bit. You would think the stock would have taken a dive post earnings when in reality it went up by 6%. It was up another 8% on Monday. And then this morning, as of Tuesday morning, it is up another 3% today. So it's gone up quite a bit. I'm not exactly sure why for the big escalation in price. I mean, that amount in 3 days, but the company said that the warmer winter is no doubt having an impact. And I'm starting to wonder if maybe investors are treating this as a bit of a one-off and the results actually aren't as bad as they seem because, you know, that warmer winter might just be offsetting earnings for a single year, because that is pretty much the only segment you're seeing struggling right now is things like snowmobiles. So much so that when you exclude the snowmobile numbers from the overall company numbers, like considering the circumstances, you know, economically, that we're in, like sky-high policy rates, you know, lower spending, like they're still growing earnings and, or sorry, revenue. So earnings are declining and sales aren't growing as fast as they were. But I mean, again, considering, you know, the situation we're in, it's really not that bad. So overall sales in the fourth quarter showed a decline of 10%. But when you strip snowmobiles out, revenue only declined 2%. So on the year, total sales grew by 8%. And if you strip out the decline in snowmobiles, it actually grew at a 12% clip. So this is pretty much a pure recreational vehicle company. So, I mean, the fact that they're still selling right now, as mentioned, is pretty good. And they issued their fiscal 2025 outlook. So this is one of those companies that is kind of like half a year ahead in terms of fiscal years. So their next quarter, which will be the second quarter of, you know, the calendar year 2024, will be their first quarter fiscal 2025. So it's just a bit of a weird year end. So that's why you're seeing these types of, you know, years. But they expect revenue to be in the $9.1 to $9.5 billion range. And earnings will come in around $7.25 to $8.25. So this would be declines of 8.3% on revenue and 25% on earnings. However, it states that the warm winter will be impacting the start of fiscal 2025 as well. And they figure it'll hurt earnings by about $1.25 per share throughout the whole year. So if we were to kind of look at this as a one-time event, you could possibly see how, you know, a return to normal in terms of winter conditions could pretty much result in a pretty big jump in earnings almost right away for the company. So, I mean, it seemed like most of the declines in earnings were already priced in. In terms of other notable items on the guidance, so it expects CapEx of around $500 million, which would be a $86 million reduction from last year. And it expects to close out fiscal 2025 with a share count of 76.2 million. So this is about a 3% dip. And if you followed BRP for any amount of time, like it buys back shares like crazy. So over the last 10 years, it's bought back 37% of its total shares outstanding. 22% of those buybacks have come in the last 5 years. They've started to return more money to shareholders through dividend growth. They kind of slowed down dividend growth, and even I believe they even halted the dividend, or at least reduced it during the pandemic, but they raised it this quarter by 17%. It's getting back on track to becoming a pretty strong dividend growth stock. And just overall, it's like, if you were to look at strict declines in numbers, it's really not all that good of a quarter on the surface, but in reality, they're operating pretty well considering how much of a struggle it's been for a lot of consumers. I mean, right now, I don't even know who's thinking of, like, what are you financing a snowmobile or a boat at, like 10% right now? I just can't imagine.
Yeah, I mean, do you know if they, like, they're working through a backlog? Because I know they had a big backlog during the I mean,
and it's going down yet.
2022, right?
Yeah. And then they had like 2022, they had like supply chain issues and all that kind of stuff that was impacting them. I mean, it's been a crazy few years for the company, but they have huge market share. I believe, I can't remember what their market share is in the snowmobile space. It's over 50%. I think it's pretty crazy and it's continuing to grow. So yeah, it was pretty good quarter, all things considered.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know exactly what the valuation is at here, but to me, it's something I would approach with caution. I mean, it's not too bad.
It's only trading at 10.9x expected earnings.
Okay, that's not too bad. Yeah, I mean, as long as the earnings go go the way as they hope, right?
Yeah, so. I mean, if you look at, this is just 10-year median price to earnings ratio of 20x, and right now it's trading at 10.6. So, I mean, it's a lot different of an environment, I think. Like, you know, it was a pretty good bull run from, what would that be, 2014 till 2024. So, yeah, it's, I mean, they're only trading at 7.3x their trailing free cash flow. So, I mean,
that's not too bad. Yeah, I think it's just obviously the overhanging thing is if there's macroeconomic headwinds in North America, that could definitely impact the results. And are they, my other question, I don't know the company super well, but you know, how much was the backlog masking a potential decline in demand is probably the other question I've had for the business.
Yeah, it's, I mean, that's definitely something to consider. They do expect a slowdown again this year, but then they, like, just if we look at analyst numbers, but it's really, really hard to actually project into 2026, 2027. It's pretty much a guessing game at that point, but they do expect, you know, 2025 to be relatively rough and then rebound again in 2026 and 2027, which, I mean, kind of lines up with how you'd figure, you know, policy rates and everything go. If we expect, you know, rate drops end of this year, early next year, I mean, that could spur some more spending because, again, like, I would imagine the financing rates on these things are not cheap and the products just aren't cheap either. I mean, I don't know who could afford one right now, but I mean, it was relatively easy during the pandemic, which is why they saw some pretty crazy growth. But I mean,
the Fed put, baby.
Yeah,
that's that's what you got to bank on. But no, that was interesting. I mean, I know Braden follows this one pretty
closely. I own a pretty small position in them, so I guess. Yeah.
No, it's, I think Bombardier was once a darling in Quebec and they just managed to sell off every good part of the business.
Exactly.
So, they did quite well. Yeah, they did quite well. But let's move on to something more entertaining. I thought that was a good transition. Yeah. So Trump Media IPO. So last week, the merger between DWAC and I guess it's Trump Social Media Group, something like that. Let's just say Trump and Truth Social was approved. DWAC was the SPAC that was announced that it would eventually merge with Truth Social. The announcement had been made more than 2 years ago, but was delayed because of an SEC probe that was eventually settled for $18 million last July, and that would need to be paid should the merger happen. Now, for those who are newer to the podcast or not familiar what a SPAC is, so that's a special purpose acquisition company. We talked in 2021 how there was a lot of euphoria in the markets, a lot of valuations got stretched. Well, SPACs were definitely definitely part of those because, they traded pretty pricey, didn't really make much sense. And a SPAC is basically a shell company that IPOs with the sole purpose of acquiring or merging with a company. And during the pandemic, like I said, we saw a lot of these SPACs IPO and the hype around them was just crazy. They would go up and there was just on the rumor that they might merge with a specific business without any concrete evidence. That's how crazy it was. And they would typically list for $10. And then you'd see the SPAC kind of go crazy during the 2021 boom. And if you look at the SPAC and new issue ETF ticker SPCX, it's down close to 30% since its highs of February 2021. I think it started trading around that time, if I remember correctly, that ETF. Now, if we go back to the WAC merger with Trump Media and Technology Group, so that's the official name, but I mean, it just has one brand underneath it as Truth Social, which is Trump, you know, social media platform. And the stock now trades under ticker DJT, which is also the initials of Donald J. Trump, and is now known as, again, like I said, as Trump Media and Technology Group. The company had a net cash position of $245 million as of December 31st, 2023. They had a bit more than $4 million in revenue last year. So that's quite the gear in revenue.
Yeah.
You can probably hear my sarcasm here. They lost $58 million. They had a net loss of $58 million on that $4 million of revenue last year. And although the company hadn't reported user metric, the estimation I've seen was that they have around 5 million users per month globally and 1 million user per month specific to the US. And for comparison, Twitter has over 350 million monthly users worldwide and over 50 million the US alone. So it's not even close to what an X or Facebook or, you know, name your social media platform that's well known. And there is also a key individual risk here to the business. Obviously, if anything happens to Trump, if Trump doesn't use the platform as much, I mean, he's not young either. I think he's in his late 70s at this point. Like, is he like 78 or something like that?
Yeah, I think when he was president, he was like 74, 75. So yeah, he'd be up there.
Yeah, he's 77, yeah. So it was pretty close. So he's 77. Obviously, I mean, I don't know what his health is and whatnot, but that's definitely a key risk for this company that's so reliant on this one person. I mean, the brand is literally built around him. And at the same time, it could be a really interesting stock just to look at from a social point of view, I would say, because, you know, whatever you think about Trump, I think it's fair to say that he has a very loyal following who may want to buy this stock simply because they believe in him, regardless of what the business does, just to show his support for him. And, you know, I think it's probably going to be a bit of a meme stock, but with an added element of loyalty to the shareholder base because of that. I think it'll be fascinating just to kind of see how it looks like in the coming months, especially when the lockout period comes up, which Trump owns a lot of the stock. I can't remember exactly what the numbers are, but right now what's happening is there's a very small float. So that just means that there's not that many shares that are available on the public markets. And when the lock-in period ends, there's going to most likely be a flood of new shares coming to the market. And what will that have as an impact on the existing shares? I don't know. But typically, if there's a lot of people selling, obviously, if the demand is not there to buy those shares, then it will pressure the stock price down. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, obviously, people who invest in this are not really kind of investing in the company. I think they're more gambling. I think that's fair to say. But again, I think there's just so many dynamics at play. I just don't think the business is that relevant for this stock, to be honest. It's rare that I say that, but I just don't think it is.
Yeah, I mean, they have, you're talking about shareholder loyalty, and it seems like you would have to be pretty loyal because they have $4 million in revenue and their market cap, from what I'm looking at, is $6 billion.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. So I mean, it's probably fluctuated from a billion or two in the last couple of days anyways. So.
I mean, these SPACs are just crazy. I do remember it back in 2021. It was absolutely crazy. I remember they even had, oh man, I can't remember the name. They had a guy on YouTube. They actually called him, well, he called himself the SPAC man. And he had like a little logo. I think his logo was like the Pac-Man guy. And he was like eating word SPAC. What was the big one? Oh, it was Tattooed Chef, I think. They were a big SPAC, and I think they went bankrupt not too long ago. I'm pretty sure were a SPAC. Okay. Yeah, that was just complete euphoria. This seems to be nothing short of the same. I mean, what did Twitter sell for? It was $42 billion or something?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
And they have 70 times the user base as this?
Yeah, and advertisers, and you know, like much more active user base. And I think that's the issue, right? What if Trump stops, you know, truthing, whatever that's called, on the truthing on the platform, posting on the platform? Obviously, that's a big risk. Advertisers may not want to advertise there. I mean, some may be reluctant because they, you know, they don't want to be seen as partisan or something like that. So there's definitely a lot of things to take into account. Nonetheless, I mean, they may be able to tap to the public markets pretty easily if, again, there's this loyal following for Trump that's ready to put money in it. It's just, I just find it fascinating. There's just so much in terms of the social aspect around it.
Oh, for sure. Like, he's pretty much the entire thing. Like, if he isn't around, I mean, who's, what's the point of going on the platform, really? I mean, crazy times.
G-D-J-T-G-A-R. So Donald J. Trump Jr. That would be the
name. Oh, yeah,
ticket.
True. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Oh, I think enough about this meme stock. I think we've covered it enough. You want to go over Innovalis REIT earnings? And we're definitely talking about some smaller names. Clearly, earnings season is winding down here.
Yeah. So this one I had thought about because last quarter we talked about it and it was just, the REIT is in some pretty rough shape. So this is, they're pretty much a European office REIT. So I'm pretty sure they have a lot of exposure to France, Spain, Germany, I believe. So where it all started to go downhill for the REIT was, I believe it was in 2020 or 2021. So they bought a sole occupied building in Paris for $51 million. By sole occupied, I mean there's one tenant that occupies the entire building. So it was meant to improve FFO, funds from operations, per unit in the high single digit range. But in 2022, the company got notice that the tenant would just not be renewing its lease and it would be leaving the building completely. So they bought a sole occupied tenant building for $51 million, which is quite considerable considering the size of the REIT. And the tenant had a 2-year lease left on it, and it's a sole occupied building. So the tenant left, the building is, you know, down to 0% occupancy. So, I mean, the company is down 82% over the last 3 years. It halted the distribution. So, I mean, it was trading pre-COVID at around $11.20 a share, and it's now $1.20. And again, as of right now, the occupancy rate is 0% over 334,000 square feet of space that is just not getting leased. I took a quick look at their occupancy rates in their annual report. They just put their average occupancy rate on France properties is just over 50, with one building being at 32%. And of course, the acquired building being at 0%. The company has around 37% of its leases maturing in the next few years. I'm pretty curious as to whether or not they'll be able to drive rent increases, considering, like, I mean, you got to imagine if you're in a building they offer and it's 37% occupied. I mean, you're probably, you have so much leverage in that aspect of things.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
But yeah, they reported adjusted funds from operations of just a penny on the quarter. So this is down from 11 cents when we look to Q4 of last year. And overall, adjusted funds were down 20%. The fair value of its investment properties for the company has declined by 6.5%. Debt to gross book value is up. Weighted average interest rates on its loans have increased from 1.93% to 2.75%. Considering the company's average loan to maturity is just 2.9 years, it's probably safe to say the company needs rates to come down. Interest coverage ratios dropped from 3.5x to 2.4x. So I find Innovalis interesting in a way because it highlights the fact that often where there's smoke, there's fire. This company traded like very cheaply for quite some time, but I mean, it was probably just a result of, you know, the single client leaving its Paris building. It's been downhill all since. Another thing is this company had a very high yield for a long time. So if you did a quick screen on REITs, you'd probably find this company at a very low valuation with a very high dividend yield, but it kind of looks that like obviously the writing here was kind of on the wall. And it still just kind of blows my mind that the company would make an acquisition that large on a single building with a single tenant that has less than a couple years left on the lease. So I mean, the pandemic didn't really help all that much. And I would imagine if this was pre-pandemic, they probably filled the building a little bit easier. But I mean, it was a risk nonetheless. It kind of shows you that, you know, these management teams on any sort of company, like, they're human. They make some pretty big mistakes at times.
Yeah. I mean, it's when did they do that purchase for that building?
It was either late 2020 or 2021. Let me look it up.
Well, they were bullish on the working from home trend not continuing, yeah. I guess.
Let me see.
Yeah, and sometimes too, you'll find management just feel pressured to do something to make the company grow. But sometimes, I mean, it's better to be patient, especially when you get into leverage, because let's be honest, like, REITs are typically pretty highly levered. I think it's around 60-65%, I think, for most REITs in terms of leverage ratios. So if you take on more leverage, I mean, you better be sure that it's a good move, because, you know, Dan Foch and I will have an episode coming soon about real estate, and that's one of the things we talked about, right? Leverage can really magnify your gains, but it can completely crush you if it goes the wrong way.
Works both ways, yeah. Just quick search. It looks like it was the worst timing ever, because it was in late 2019. So, I mean, You're talking like they didn't do it during the pandemic. It was prior to the pandemic, but I mean, God, that's just horrible timing.
Yeah.
January 23rd, yeah, exactly. 2020, it was announced, and 2 months later, global pandemic. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I guess management can be forgiven a little bit there, just because obviously if the pandemic doesn't happen, it probably looks way different. But again, I think it's still something to keep in mind when you have just one tenant or any other kind of business, when you just have one customer or just a handful of, like, major customers. If you end up losing one of those, it can really impact your revenues. And I think that's one of the things that we talked about NVIDIA is, you know, most of their revenues are coming just from three, four key customers. And at the end of the day, that's a risk. People may think that it's not a risk, or they might dismiss it, but they're wrong. It's still a risk. Will it materialize? Maybe, maybe not. But the concentration of that customer base is definitely a big risk.
Yeah. And I mean, in this situation, I mean, it seems to me like if you were to go and purchase this building with that short of a lease, you think you would, you know, maybe try to negotiate prior to the purchase.
In advance,
because it just killed them. It was, I just thought it was interesting to talk about, because, like I said, I think it was maybe even two quarters ago we talked about it, and, it hasn't gotten any better. It's actually gotten worse.
Yeah, I guess, you know, buyer beware. Yeah. Well, on this note, I think I'll have time to do a quick recap. So I had done these earnings a while back, and I figured it would be a good idea just to look at it, because speaking of pandemic, this was a name that was pretty affected. So Cineplex, they came out with their earnings about a month ago. I'll do it quickly here. So total revenues were up 26% to $1.4 billion for the year. Box office revenues were up 30% to $600 million. Food revenues up 27% to $483 million. Media revenue was up 6% to $119 million. Amusement revenues were up 20% to $97 million. And then other was up 34% to $91 million. Net income was positive, but that was only because of deferred income taxes. They had an operating loss of $9.5 million versus $10.4 million last year, so essentially unchanged from that standpoint. The good news is that they generated $157 million of free cash flow for the year, which is almost three times that of the previous year. Free cash flow per share has been slowly trended up since 2020, but still well below pre-pandemic. And that's kind of the thing, the theme here is a lot of the things are still well below pre-pandemic level. Management said that they were pleased with the result, especially despite having box office supply challenges in 2023. If we think back of 2023, there was the actor and the writer strike, which affected the quality of movies, if you'd like, that came to the big screen. And according to them, they outperformed their North American peers by 785 basis points for box office revenue growth. They have now over 14 million members of their Scene Plus Loyal program, which, you know, I'm one of them and I haven't used it in forever. So we'll take that with a grain of salt. But and they expect 2024 to be strong, especially now that, again, the actor and writer strikes are in the rearview mirror. One thing that's not so great for Cineplex is their interest expense. It's grown 27% year over year and has increased from $122 million to $155 million. They also announced that they had issued $575 million of senior secured notes at a rate of 7.625%. So, I mean, It is interesting. I know one of the things I had looked and I forgot to add, I guess I was working off a spreadsheet here, but their revenues and the attendance is still significantly down compared to pre-pandemic level. There's a big gap in, you know, the drop in attendance and the revenue compared to pre-pandemic levels. So the revenues are closer because they're clearly charging more, but the foot traffic is just not back just there yet. So I don't know whether that will pick back up, whether people are just deciding that, you know what, it's not worth it to spend money on that or not. So it'll be interesting how it actually evolves in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I think the foot traffic is probably down. I think maybe because of just the lack of good movies that are coming out recently. I mean, maybe because of the that probably would have been a bit, but because of the strike, I mean, we had Oppenheimer and then what was that other one that was big? Barbie.
Barbenheimer,
yeah. And then we had, I think, late last year, I don't know if it would still be impacting them this quarter, but they had the Taylor Swift. I think you could go there and see her concerts or whatever. So that drove, like, I remember that was a huge chunk of their foot traffic. But they're just, like, I'm somebody who's, so my wife has a Scene card. Okay. And she uses it all the time. Like, I don't think we've paid for a movie in 10 years. Because we don't go very often, and when we do, like, it's always on the house. But, like, there's been absolutely nothing.
You know what
nothing.
They say, huh?
What?
You're richer than you think.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Scene points. Yeah, it's...
I was able to find the difference. So they had, essentially, the attendance is down about, like, 28% over that time frame. So 2019 to the most recent year. And then the revenues are down 15%. So they were able to, I guess, charge more. But again, the foot traffic is just not back yet. So it'll be interesting. I mean, we haven't gone, but I think for us, it's more a reflection of having an 18-month-old.
Yeah.
You know, and finding a babysitter and all that stuff. I'm sure we'll try to go when we have a chance. Yeah.
The movie gets a lot more expensive when you got to pay for all that. Cineplexes. Exactly. God, they used to be one of the, like, I'm pretty sure they're one of the faster growing Canadian stocks for a while. And then I believe they got like a buyout offer from, I can't remember what that cinema place was.
Yeah.
But it fell through or something. And then it just ended up bombing.
Yeah. I think it was. So they had a buyout offer.
Cineworld, I want to say.
Right before the pandemic.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was right before the pandemic, and then they backed out because of the pandemic.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it went to court or some. Yeah. I'm just going based on memory. That was a while back, but yeah.
$2.8 billion they got. The offer was for $2.8 billion.
Okay.
And right now, Cineplex has a market cap of $450 million. So that's
that's a good move.
That is a very good move.
By Cineworld or whoever, yeah.
Even though they probably had to pay some fees, I'm sure has been more than worth it for them to dodge that bullet.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think that's it for today. I think it was still a good episode. I appreciate people bearing with me despite my stuffiness and difficulty pronouncing certain English words. But I think it should be better next week, although I suspect I may be coughing a little bit. That's usually how it goes for me. I get a cold and then turns into a cough after. But if you haven't done so, you know, make sure you give us a review. We do appreciate it. It helps us, you know, helps people find us, talk to us about to a friend, family member, that helps as well. So give us a review, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to us on. You can find me at @Fiat_Iceberg on Twitter/X and Dan at stock trades_CA, right?
Yep, that is it. Thanks for listening, everybody.
The Canadian Investor Podcast should not be construed as investment or financial advice. The hosts and guests featured may own securities or assets discussed on this podcast. Always do your own due diligence or consult with a financial professional before making any financial or investment decisions.